I'm Ken Nash, and with Mimi Rosenberg, produce, and you're listening to Building Bridges, Part 2 of Malcolm X's Black Radical Tradition and Legacy. Malcolm X, we come together today not to mourn Malcolm X, but to praise our griot. From his message through the grassroots to the ballot of the bullet, Malcolm X, our griot, our prophetic voice to educate, agitate, and organize, to empower because, as Malcolm X said to his discussion with James Baldwin, we're not willing to wait another 100 years. Malcolm X and the era of MAGAism, Trumpism. We're joined by Abdul Akalamat, an American professor of African American studies, a founder of the field of black studies and activist. He's the author of several books on African American studies and including Malcolm X for Beginners, and he curates two websites related to African American history, Malcolm X, a research site, and Black Studies. And William W. Sales, Jr., Professor Emeritus and Chairperson of the Department of African American Studies and our Director of Center for African American Studies at Seton Hall. A recognized expert on Malcolm X, Dr. Sales is the author of two books, From Civil Rights to Black Liberation, Malcolm X and the Reorganization of African American Unity, and Southern Africa, Black America, Same Struggle, Same Fight. Dr. Sill is a veteran of the civil rights and student power movements. His activism is head of the campus chapter of the NAACP at Penn in 1963-4, led to the formation and adoption of the Philadelphia Plan for the Integration of the Building Trades.
Abdul Akalamat, William Sales, your thoughts upon listening to Malcolm's righteous announcement of the creation of the Organization for Afro-American Unity and some of its initial principles.
I was very much impressed by Malcolm's honesty, which was not only a personal attribute, but an intellectual honesty as well. Malcolm's honesty was facing up the facts. The truth is the only basis for change. And it didn't matter what the cost was in doing this. His honesty was the basis of his openness to people and ideas with which he differed. And, you know, Malcolm not only talked about the need to struggle by any means necessary, but he also told us what that might cost us. You remember his quote, perchance, and he said this: until the American black man lets white people know that we are really ready and willing to pay the price that is necessary for freedom, our people always will be walking around here as second-class citizens of what you call 20th century slaves. And then he let us know what the price might be for that freedom when he said, the price of freedom is death. So Malcolm was brutally honest. And there are just a few aspects of his honesty and observations that I like to talk about. I'd like to start with his notion of facing facts, as Malcolm did. You know, we're psychologically as a people and culturally in bad shape. Malcolm taught us that we experience a spiritual death in denial, self-hatred, and lack of knowledge of true self. This was the Negro of which he spoke. Today we might think that we have left that Negro far behind, that we are today resurrected as black men and women. But this is not true. Malcolm X recognized that black liberation had to begin with the psychological emancipation of black people from their internalized sense of racial inferiority. This quote, unbrainwashing of an entire people, end quote, required a psychological reconciliation with Africa and an embrace of the entire history of people of African descent before and after the Holocaust of the slave trade and slavery. Malcolm often reminded his audiences of this when he said, quote, while you say you're no African, you left your mind in Africa, end quote. Malcolm felt that if we are to struggle against the oppression put upon us, We as a people must change, especially by struggling against our own weaknesses. Malcolm admonished us to get educated, learn some history, and face facts. This was his method. Another observation that I passed through the prism of Malcolm is this fact. Fascism is upon us. Donald J. Trump is a fascist. The Democratic Party leadership colludes with fascists. White supremacist paramilitaries have been killing our people, and all of the foregoing is endorsed and accorded respect by white Christian nationalists. Way back in 1967, Dr. King said that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. It's no different today, save that this country now destroys whole nations and people in the pursuit of resources and global hegemony. Today, the United States is brazenly fascist at home and a hydra-headed imperialist cancer abroad. In the face of this, a third fact. Electoral politics alone will not save us. It is a tool of oppression, not liberation. Malcolm warned us about subservience to the two major parties. His analogy was that of the wolf and the fox. Both of these animals are carnivores. The Republicans he saw as the wolves, clearly a mortal threat. But he's warned of the danger of the Democrats because they were sly and cunning like the fox, but ultimately no less dangerous than the wolf. Malcolm warned us that even with the vote, we continue to be powerless. Remember what he said, and I quote him very briefly. When you take your case to Washington, D.C., you're taking it to the criminal who's responsible. It's like running from the wolf to the fox. They're all in cahoots together, end quote. In the face of this fascism, let's not forget another fact highlighted by Malcolm. Every brother ain't a brother, and every sister ain't a sister. Malcolm X let us know that the plantation was still with us, and as well the house Negroes and the field Negroes. He was among the first to expose the emerging Black leadership class. Probably one of the most important things that Malcolm pointed us to. Another fact. There is no racial emancipation while capitalism exists. Malcolm X warned us that capitalism is not the solution to our problem. It is our problem. It is the godfather of racism, sexism, and classism. Malcolm knew this. He was clear, very clear, when he said, quote, you can't have capitalism without racism. You can't operate a capitalistic system unless you are vulturistic. You show me a capitalist, I'll show you a bloodsucker. End quote. Malcolm told us that we were all in prison. He experienced that as a teenager and young adult in the 1940s. This has become the norm for so many of our young folk in the first two decades of the 20th century. Our young people are subjected to a future defined by the school-to-prison pipeline and the prison-industrial complex. We continue to experience enslavement, albeit of another type. The new Jim Crow is not new at all. Capitalism is part of the holy trinity of oppression, along with racism and imperialism. That trinity is well along the way to destroying our race, our African nations, and the planet itself. Malcolm X's political philosophy could most accurately be described as pan-African internationalism. It increasingly tied the liberation of Black people here to the struggle against imperialism everywhere. He recognized that as Black people began to struggle everywhere, they looked to some form of socialist alternative to capitalism around which to build their futures. For all of these facts and observations of Malcolm, only 4 days after the founding of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, J. Edgar Hoover issued a memorandum to all 50 agents in charge of the major bureaus in the United States. He did this on July 2nd, that Malcolm X and his Organization of Afro-American Unity had to be destroyed. Later on, this same individual created COINTELPRO to nullify the legacy of Malcolm X, to prevent the emergence of another militant nationalist Black leader who could capture the imagination of the youth. Today, we're 70 years beyond the assassination of Malcolm, 60 years beyond, and on the eve almost of his centennial. And so much of what he says is so relevant and rings so true today, almost in spades, one would say. And I think that it's appropriate, because of his continued resonance, that we study him deeply, that we reproduce his methodology by which he arrived at knowledge, by which he arrived at an analysis and a basis for moving forward. Malcolm is still relevant today. And that analysis is grounded in a method that starts with knowing the history of our problems, because that history tells us where they originated, how they developed, and suggest what might be through that diagnosis or prognosis of how we can go forward in the present in order to change things for the better in the future. But I know that Abdul, who spent his whole life around a methodology of liberation, and Malcolm plays a crucial role in the development of that methodology, have much more to say about this.
Thank you very much, Bill. That was very important. Facts matter. Very important. I'd like to continue by adding two points of focus on Malcolm. One, reminding all of us that the autobiography, his memoir, is a very important statement, because there are four stages of his life represented by different names: Malcolm Little, Detroit Red, Malcolm X, Malik Shabazz. Each one of those stages really is a mapping of the Black experience generally. And people can identify with, so as a model of autobiography. This, of course, is very important because the autobiography is such an important genre in American experience and in really global experience. And Malcolm's autobiography fits into that literature. So I want to remind people that that's a book we need to continue to read and study. The second point I want to make is that Malcolm is a guide to consciousness, to revolutionary consciousness. Now, most of his words that we have come through interviews, panel discussions, and speeches. And Malcolm was famous for responding to that call, "Make it plain, Malcolm, make it plain." And so when he spoke, he often used agitational tactics by taking key concepts and helping us to really remember those concepts. That's why I think the two speeches, Message to the Grassroots and The Ballot or Bullet, are so important for us. And when I say important, I mean not just to understand what Malcolm said, but following his direction to us to think for ourselves, so we can take Malcolm's words and help us understand theory that we so desperately need at this moment of, as Bill pointed out, facing fascism. We have to understand the history of it and understand how we can get free. That takes theory. And so the new generation of activists have a lot of activism, but what we need is theory, and Malcolm can guide us there. In the ballot, in the Message to the Grassroots, Malcolm starts out by emphasizing four concepts: unity, land, bloodshed, and that house field contradiction. These are very important concepts. When we put them into a theoretical, we stretch them, we expand them in the context of the theory that we need. So I'm suggesting, for example, that when Malcolm talked about unity, he was really guiding us to the whole concept of the African-American national question. He emphasized the common enemies that we have. But also he was suggesting that there's something historical when he started connecting us to Africa. So there's an Africa continuation in the context of this new experience we're having as compared to, say, Jamaica or Brazil, et cetera. Those are all an expression of this African diaspora, but it's also the independent national experiences that also represent differences. So unity is really trying to understand us as a people. The second concept of land helps us to and guides us to political economy, land, labor, capital. Third concept, bloodshed. He was talking about war, but in the context of the message of the grassroots, as well as Battle of the Bullet, what he's really guiding us to is understanding the tactical and strategic understanding of reform and revolution. Malcolm was not against struggle. And struggle is one step at a time as we fight our way through this jungle of oppression. But he also was pointing us to those decisive strategic moments when we can transform the society in which we live. That was very important as part of the Black liberation debate of the 1960s, and we have to revisit that. And this last concept of House Field is so very important because he points us in the direction of a class analysis, that we have to understand the class dynamics of the society in which we live. But in addition to those four concepts, he then takes us, just as Bill suggested, to history. And he talks about seven different revolutionary experiences that we can learn from. Comprehensive. First, capitalism. He directs us to the US and to France. Second, socialism. He directs us to study the Soviet Union and China. And third, the national liberation struggles. He directs us to study Algeria, Kenya, and Cuba. That's a curriculum. In other words, Malcolm then becomes the basis for a curriculum for the development in this current moment of activism to the development of cadre, people who are knowledgeable and committed to a discipline of study and struggle. That's what Malcolm was really about. Those of you who really would take a look at the OAU, the organization, even when he was in the Nation of Islam, Malcolm was a serious educator and teacher of people who wanted to do something, and he was transforming them into cadre for Black liberation. So that's really at that exact moment of 2025. We have activism of the Black Lives Matter movement. We even have sisters that were part of the Me Too movement. And we certainly have young brothers and sisters who are on the campus fighting against this Palestinian genocide. Activism is important. But what Malcolm helps us to see is we need higher levels of consciousness to go along with our coordinated collective action. We need cadre. So the young people today, in studying Malcolm, do so with the intent of becoming cadre. Malcolm is so very important. And this year of 100th anniversary of his birth gives us a symbolic moment to relive energy in our study of Malcolm. And that's why I thank you so much, Mimi, for this program. We really appreciate being here and talking to your audience.
Okay. What can Malcolm really teach us? How do we begin to meld that theory and practice, the differentiation between reform and revolution at this time of escalating inequality and imperialist violence, where indeed we are, and I do believe, in a period that we have sufficiently consolidated the plutocrats and the oligarchs and autocrats to wind up in a state of advancing fascism. So where does Malcolm and your probing of his works take us in terms of beginning the process of really dismantling the capitalist process and breaking that stranglehold of capital and empire?
Well, it's clear that their attack on DEI is the resurgence of structural racist tactics of oppression. It's not just about some abstract concepts. It's a direct aggression of racism against Black people in all forms. When the person who was being interviewed in the committee for Secretary of Education could not respond when they asked, is it okay to teach Black history in the schools? And she couldn't respond. She said she'd have to think about whether it was illegal or not. We have to understand that this is a frontal attack on Black people. And I think one of the things that Malcolm, as Bill pointed out, challenged us to speak truth to power. And unfortunately, right now, we have the Democratic Party and we have people trying to figure out how to speak accurately about this fascist attack on Black people. In other words, we are the canary in the mine. This is the first major attack. And of course, that follows from the assassination of young Black people throughout the country. So that's the first thing, speak truth to power. The second thing, I think, and this is very important in terms of the last part of his life, is that we have to avoid a kind of ultra-leftism. What Malcolm was talking about was Black unity and finding unity among the broadest possible masses of people. This is very important because right now, it is in fact the broad masses of people that are under attack. And so I think that's really an important aspect. The last part of his life was very important as a move away from the relative sectarianism of the Nation of Islam. What do you think, Bill?
You know, one thing that always impressed me about Malcolm was that he was an autodidact. Everything I've heard other people talk, he walked around with all kind of newspapers in his pockets and books.
Doesn't that remind you of a Lumbee Brath?
it became, through Malcolm, a generational thing. Yep. When I think about brothers in the latter part of the 60s and from that point on, it was almost a badge that you had to wear. You know, you had to be reading something. I remember once I ran into some brothers some years later in 113th Street subway, 113th Street stop on the Lenox Avenue subway. And I happened to be going to pick up my wife, but I had started to reread Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, had in my hand. And some brothers, some junkies came up to me and looked at me and said, what you reading that for, brother? We read that 20 years ago. And I just thought to myself, you know, even junkies were reading Fanon, you know, in places like Harlem in the late 60s or 70s. You know, it had become part of the broader Black culture. And therefore, I think that I would like to see our young people get back to that kind of thirst for knowledge. It's more complicated now because of the attraction of, you know, social media and what have you. But to get back to, you know, to books and to knowledge and to those alternative newspapers and get excited about studying them, because Malcolm was certainly right. You know, the beginning of all emancipation comes with study and a thorough knowledge of history. And we're going to run up against the limits of spontaneity very soon. I have no doubt that our folks are going to hit the street. When I say our folks, I mean not only Black folks, brown folks, whole bunch of white folks going to hit the streets against this thing.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen is it will, in all likelihood, be repressed, right? Then the question is, what do we do? Right? Our historical experience tells us we're going to get in the streets, and it tells us also that repression is coming. How are we going to sustain ourselves and get past that? It's always been a problem for us in the past, right? But I think that, you know, the kind of thing we're talking about, kind of systematic study and testing some of those preliminary lessons in the crucible practice, is what's actually going to liberate us. You know, because certainly the truth will make you free, and the truth is based on an adequate and proper understanding of the facts.
See, another aspect of that is back in the day, the conversation occurred everywhere. Barbershop, the bookstore, the subway platform. The debate was on. Even Malcolm was not just a reverend. He was encountered and debated on every street corner and sitting in the coffee shops, and et cetera. So what we need to do is we need to unleash a democratic discussion, a rebirth of the political political culture of debate. And one of the great dangers of fascism is fear. It's forcing people to be afraid. People right now are afraid of their jobs, are afraid to teach the right stuff so they don't get criticized. And so what we need to do is to figure out how to unleash. And here I'm talking about not just the codes of hip hop, et cetera, and things that are generationally specific, but I'm talking about a more general debate. Because one of the things that we, for example, when Ferguson jumped and we went to Ferguson and we were talking to some of the young people there, they were essentially alienated from the older Black people in the town because they were like hesitant about the spontaneity of just going and confronting the police in the street. And so one of the directions we were trying to help them see is that that's the debate. You have to encounter the adults in the community, the trade unionists and the teachers and the bus drivers and the postal workers. That's the debate we need to have to achieve the unity we need to go up against the kind of, you know, evil forces that we face. And so the culture we had in the 60s of reading and debating and therefore arriving at consensus that enabled us to have higher levels of struggle.
I hope you'll both come back and continue to get us to wake up and smell the coffee even more. But what you both do, and I'd like to just, and it's, we would say in Yiddish, it's a shanda, it's a shame, but both of you, 30 seconds to help us just wind up with this piece, and we're just going to call it part one of our discussion on Griot, Malcolm saying we are not willing to wait another 100 years, and frankly, Bill Sayles, I insist that you'll be around for the beloved community, the egalitarian community that Martin Luther King worked hard to establish and that we must get to the realization of the promise of democracy. But in the last 30 seconds, and I will be strict about this, Bill, your thoughts and Abdul Akalimat.
Well, I'm very heartened by the fact that people are outraged by the fascist takeover of the government, and they're in the streets already, and I expect many, many thousands more will be. But I would also advocate that people really begin this serious, serious study of the Black radical tradition. And at the center of that, of course, a whole lot of people, not the least of which is Malcolm.
Abdul Akalimat?
Our generation of the 60s is making its transition. We were the children of Malcolm X. We were the direct legacy of Malcolm X. I'm hoping that everybody can reach out to people in our generation. We know things, and it's important to make sure that every elder that comes out of the 60s and out of the movement, out of SNCC and out of the Black Panther Party and out of the Black Radical Congress and all of the institutions, emergent institutions of struggle, use us as teachers, as fellow conspirators to organize our people in struggle.
Learn from Malcolm X. Malcolm X, thanks for listening, and educate, agitate, organize for power to the people, for a better world is surely possible, and we are the ones to help make it so.